That's right. That's right.
If it didn't have the long pairs, we would totally be away here. But for whatever reason, it's not here. In this section, they thinned out and drawn a little structure, and it kind of ended. Good morning. Really cool to have you guys here. We're going to finish off this chapter and start on the next one today. And last Friday, hope you all had a good MLK day, by the way. Last Friday, we left off with this slide. And this talks about polarity. Now, in a pure covalent bond, in theory, all of the electrons would be distributed over the molecule so that you wouldn't have any partial positive, partial negatives, or true positive or true negative species. But in reality, we do see that some of the charges are unequally distributed. And a polarity statement is just saying how much covalent bonds are different than the pure ionic bonds. So we're going to start seeing some different things. And I like this example a lot right here that compares water, H2O, to methane, CH4. And if you look at the boiling point, all right, water, as you probably know, boils at 100 degrees Celsius. Methane, which is essentially natural gas, boils at negative 161 degrees Celsius. Very, very low boiling point, which means it's a gas almost all the time. Titan, one of the moons of Saturn, supposedly has liquid methane rain. And I always thought that imagery was wild. But, you know, we're so used on the Earth to having methane as a gas. So the natural gas outlets we use, that's all methane gas, basically. But on Titan, you could actually have a rainstorm of methane. But anyway, I digress once again. The boiling points are quite different for these compounds, and we're going to start talking more about boiling. But you can think about boiling as being basically taking a molecule and throwing it in the air. And you can see by the types of compounds we have here, water is about 18 grams per mole, and methane, CH4, when you figure it out, is about 16 grams per mole. So taking those molecules and throwing them in the air, which is a very crude way of talking about boiling, the masses aren't that different, all right? Like water and methane, 18 and 16 grams per mole, about the same mass. So the difference in these boiling points is not due to the mass. If it was, they would have boiling points which were much, much closer to each other. And as you can see, it's like 261 degrees difference between them. So the reason why water boils so much higher than methane, despite their roughly equal masses, is because of polarity. And that's the last topic we're going to talk about, this unequal distribution of electrons. Now, another thing we've seen a lot in this class even so far, like the copper salts in the lab last week dissolve really well in water. Water is almost, I hate to use the word, almost magical in its ability to dissolve ionic compounds. Compounds that are really hard to boil and melt dissolve usually quite readily in water. And that's another effect of this polarity thing. So polarity really does deserve a little bit more comment than we've done so far, and that's what we'll talk about now.
When the balloon is rubbed with wool, the wool imparts a static electric charge to the balloon. When we place the balloon near the water, the stream is attracted to the balloon. The polar water molecules act as though they have an electric charge as well. Water molecules carry no overall electric charge, but they do exhibit polarity. The positively charged end of the water molecules and the negatively charged balloon attract each other.
in the lab this week, we will draw the Lewis structure for water. And water has two lone pairs and two connections to hydrogen. So oxygen, like all the period two elements, needs its octet, needs four bonds. Oxygen has two bonding pairs and two lone pairs. And because of those two lone pairs, you have a lot more electron density up here. Like the electrons are on this quote unquote side of the molecule. And this side has a lot less electron density. Hydrogen, as you know, is almost more likely to become positive than negative. So you'll see how these waters are located here. They start off in a random configuration. And next to the big negative balloon, which was done by static electricity, and this is kind of fun to do at your house, by the way. Anyway, what happens is the positive sides of water go towards the negative. This is all Coulomb's law, once again, positives and negatives coming together. The waters will actually move towards the negative side. Their positive side goes towards it, and the negative side, which is usually represented by the oxygen, tries to get away. Like charges attract, similar charges repel. So you can actually make the water stream, if it's very, very thin, you can't use like, you know, a big sink of water going down. If it's very thin, you can actually make the water move towards the static charge, which is kind of a cool thing. All of these effects, again, are due to actual partial charges on things. We call molecules like water or HCl here as polar because they do have slight positive and slight negative. Now in a true ionic bond, you would have absolute positives and negatives like sodium and chloride. That's a positive sodium and a negative chloride. The electron is truly transferred. In a polar molecule, you don't have complete transfer of electrons, but you do have more electrons on one side than the other. So the oxygen in water is the negative part of the molecule. The chloride in HCl is the negative part of the molecule. So dipoles, all right, which is where polar comes from, dipoles are just a separation of charge. It's not a true positive and a true negative like an ionic compound, but it's partial positive. You can draw little partial charges like this. This is a lowercase delta symbol, and it represents the positive charge on the hydrogen and the positive charge on the chloride. Sometimes you'll see this system too. It's like an arrow. The arrow is pointing towards the negative dipole, and the positive part, if you will, that little cross thing right there, that would be the positive part of the hydrogen. So we would say the chloride has a slight negative charge. It's not like chloride in NaCl, which is truly negative one. It's a partial negative charge. And hydrogen has a slight positive charge, delta plus. These are really interesting when you place them in electric fields. In electric fields, polar molecules will actually orient themselves with the field. So this is some molecule with a dipole, maybe HCl, maybe water, who knows. But the positive side will attract the negative dipoles of the molecule, and the negative part will attract the positive sides. Excuse me. So if this was water, the hydrogens would be blue, and the oxygen part of water would be the yellow, the white ones. And so the white, the negative is attracted to positive, etc. If you have a true nonpolar molecule, and methane, CH4 is an example of that, they could care less about electric fields. They kind of just wander around and do their thing. But most molecules we'll see are polar, and they are interested then when you place them in electric fields. A dipole moment, which is something you'll hear once in a while, is actually a way that scientists can measure how polar something is. It gets the symbol mu, another Greek symbol. It's measured in something called the Debye, which is the scientist's name who started analyzing this stuff. We won't go so far into dipole moments, but just realize there is a way to actually measure how polar something is, and you can do that if you want. In our class, what we're going to do is think really about what polarity means. And polarity is really interesting because the amount of energy required to break a bond is greater than what you'd expect. So if you had a pure hydrogen chloride bond and you wanted to break it up, it would be, they calculate, about 339 kilojoules per mole. But in reality, polarity adds a lot more energy to make these things break up. And HCl actually takes about 432 kilojoules to break up. So what happened is a scientist named Pauling, who we'll see here in a little bit, he looked at the difference between what the bond should be and what it actually is, and he correlated it into a concept called electronegativity. And electronegativity gets a fancy symbol called chi, yet another Greek symbol. We're seeing the Greeks all over today. Chi, which looks like an italicized X, is what electronegativity all is about. And it's just a number. It's a number that usually goes no larger than 4, and it's never negative. I think sometimes it can be very close to 0, but I don't think it can be 0 either. So these values of electronegativity can be found in tables and in our textbook and online, stuff like that. You will see different types of values, but generally speaking, all right, fluorine is the most electronegative of all, and it has a value of 4. And you can see that generally speaking, as you go up and to the right, electronegativity increases. So francium down here is the least electronegative. You go up, up, up until you get up to fluorine, all right? So we're gonna start using this idea, and it's not that you have to know values of electronegativity, but it is very helpful to know that fluorine is the most electronegative, and when you stare at this long enough, oxygen is second, and then basically things closer to fluorine are more electronegative than things further from fluorine. So electronegativity is really another type of a periodic trend, like the sizes of atoms, like electron affinity. Electronegativity increases up and to the right. Why this is important to us is that the lower electronegativity atoms go in the central part of a Lewis structure. So instead of always relying on the first atom listed to go in the middle part, that really it's the lowest electronegativity value that goes in the middle.
I assumed that I knew what a polypeptide chain looks like, except for the way in which it's folded. And I wanted to fold it to form the hydrogen bond. I had a cold. I was lying in bed for 2 or 3 days. And I read detective stories like reading for a while. And then I got sort of bored of that. So I said to my wife, bring me a sheet of paper. And I'll work on that problem of how polypeptide chains are folded in proteins. So she brought me sheet of paper and the slide rule and the pencil, and I started working. Well, I succeeded. It only took a couple of hours of work that day in March of 1948 for me to find the structure called the alpha helix.
Linus Pauling discovered that protein molecules have a helical structure. If we remove the hydrogen atoms from the model, we can more clearly see that the molecule twists around itself, rather like a spiral staircase. The helical structure allows a very large molecule to occupy a relatively small space.
Pauling's work on electronegativity is what we're going to talk about now, but he's a really interesting person. He is from Oregon, which is kind of cool. He has 2 Nobel Prizes. He's the only person to receive 2 unshared Nobel Prizes. Most of the time when they announce Nobel Prizes, there's several people involved, and that's totally cool. But he actually has 2 unshared prizes, 1 in chemistry and 1 in peace. And he was really involved in the anti-nuclear movement right after World War II. He was put on the banned list. He couldn't travel outside the United States for a while and stuff. Very interesting person. We'll see more about him later on and stuff as well. But if you're looking for a topic for a class presentation, I don't believe vitamin C has been claimed yet. And he did some really interesting work with vitamin C studies. So I'll leave it at that. It's kind of interesting. On Hawthorne's here in Portland, about 45th, is the Linus Pauling House. And it's all devoted to him and stuff. It's pretty interesting, but let's move on. So these electronegativity values, like I said, have a maximum value at fluorine, all right? And the lowest electronegativity atom is the one that will go in the middle of most Lewis structures. And we can also use these electronegativity values to see which bonds are more polar and less polar. So there's lots of different kinds of uses for them. Again, mostly what we'll use them for is the central atom will be the one of lowest electronegativity. Now, my own structure here reminds me, hydrogen is never in the middle because it can only handle one bond. So hydrogen is certainly less electronegative than oxygen, but hydrogen has to go on the outside. So here's an example of a type of question you might see when it comes to electronegativity. It says, which of the following groups is arranged correctly in order of increasing electronegativity? And I do not expect you to have a table of electronegativities in front of you. But what I would like you to do is think about the up and to the right thing on the periodic table. Because fluorine, again, the most electronegative atom of all. And so to order this, and if it's an increasing electronegativity, fluorine, which is one of the options, has to be the last one, all right? Fluorine has to be the last element because it's the most electronegative of all. And what you want to do then is just start in this lower left corner as possible and move to the right. So aluminum, boron, oxygen, and fluorine, aluminum is most down and to the left. Boron would be the next one. Oxygen is second only to electronegativity. And then fluorine should be the most electronegative of all. Any questions on that? If you have a table of electronegative values, though, you can do some interesting things. Like, let's say someone asked you which of these bonds was more polar. Which one had the greatest dipole separation, or dipolar is another way sometimes people talk about it. So we're going to compare OH and OF. Both of these have oxygen, but of course the other atom is different. So what you can do is look up on a table of electronegativity values. Oxygen is 3.5, fluorine is 4.0, and hydrogen is 2.1. The difference between these, absolute difference is fine. You can see that OH is 1.4 and OF is 0.5. And what this means is that OH is certainly more polar. You're going to have a separation of negative and positive, which is much greater for OH than it is for OF. O and F don't have as great of a positive-negative difference. So we would say that OH is more positive. It's more like an ionic bond. But the other interesting thing is, the most negative electronegativity element, that's going to have the negative charge. So an OH, like water up here, oxygen is the negative dipole. That's where the negative side is. But with OF, the positive part is oxygen because fluorine overpowers it. Fluorine is the most negative of all of them. So fluorine will be the negative part on OF, while oxygen would be positive, and it's kind of reversed when it comes to OH. So most of the time, oxygen is negative. Most all of the time, fluorine is negative. But you can find like absolute values using tables of electronegativity. So which of these bonded atoms do you think would have the greatest bond polarity? And we've got NO, KF, BN, SCL, and FF, all right? Now remember that bond polarity is separation so that something becomes negative and something becomes positive. And you have to have a difference in electronegativities to make this happen. So let's look at that last example first, F and F. Is there a difference in electronegativities, Silas? Is there a difference in electronegativities between two fluorine atoms? No, right on, they're the same atom, all right? So this, there's no change in electronegativity. This one is by far the most non-polar of all the different possibilities. So when you have a question like this, you want atoms which are furthest apart from each other. All right, F and F really close to each other. B and N pretty close to each other, NO right next to each other. Which of these five do you think is farthest apart from each other?
B.
Absolutely, B, the K and F. K and F are so far apart, this is probably more of an ionic compound at this point, where you have true positive on the K and true negative on the F. So if you're looking for the largest bond polarity, just try and get the atoms which are furthest from each other. So, any questions on that? Now, bonds can be polar, but you can still have non-polar molecules with those bonds. And this is another interesting thing. Basically, every bond where the atoms are different will be polar, which will mean you'll have a slightly negative and slightly positive side. But if the molecule has a symmetry, even these polar things can be overdone. Here are some examples using the five types of electron pair geometries that show that if every atom around the central atom is the same, you will have a non-polar molecule. So for example, this middle one here is CF4. The electronegativity difference between carbon and fluorine, pretty great. So this fluorine is pulling hardcore on carbon, and this one is too, and this one, and this one. But if every atom around the central one is the same, all of these different polarities cancel. CF4 has very polar bonds, but CF4 itself is a non-polar molecule. Now let me try and show, using another cheesy example, of course, what this means. Schwarzenegger, one of my kind of cheesy heroes, I'll admit. He comes down, he goes, Russell, I want to pull your arm. And of course, bad English sound effects, all right, I apologize. So Schwarzenegger, much stronger than me, doesn't eat pizza like me. Oh, he's gonna yank my arm. He could probably pull it all the way out of my socket if he wanted to. Schwarzenegger is much more electronegative than I am. He pulls my electrons much farther. However, let's say we have a twin of Schwarzenegger. Sounds like a good science fiction movie. Anyway, so Schwarzenegger's twin comes over here and goes, no, I want Russell's arm. So he pulls just as strong. And remember, these Schwarzeneggers are equal but opposite in strength, all right? So Schwarzenegger A pulls this way really hard. Schwarzenegger B pulls really hard. They're both more electronegative. They're yanking my electrons, but they cancel out. All right, they equally pull my arms in opposite directions. So even though each Russell-Schwarzenegger bond, very electronegative, pulling really hard towards it, and this one will pull just as hard in the opposite direction, they will cancel out because it's equal and opposite. And if there was, if I somehow had a third arm and we could do this, and there was a third Schwarzenegger, you could have one right there, you could be like this, right, and stuff, they would cancel out. That's why these molecules can have superpolar bonds. Schwarzenegger and was he me? But if there's enough Schwarzeneggers and they're evenly distributed around, they cancel out. So this is like me. This is Schwarzenegger. This is Schwarzenegger's twin. They pull equal but opposite. There is no net distribution. This is a nonpolar molecule. All right. Now let's be very clear. Who's your favorite tough guy?
Vin Diesel.
Oh, good choice, man. Anytime night.
Or The Rock.
The Rock. Oh, come on, just give me one. Sorry. I'm going to have one. It's okay, but I put you on the spot, man. Let's use Vin Diesel right now, because I really do have affinity for him, too. All right, Schwarzenegger, Vin Diesel. I'm not going to get into a debate as to which one's stronger, but I will say that Vin Diesel pulls differently than Schwarzenegger. Stronger, weaker, you can decide that. If you substitute one of the Schwarzeneggers for Vin Diesel, no longer will it be equal polarity. One will pull stronger than the other. So if there's even one different piece, this becomes polar. It's only if you have nothing but Schwarzeneggers or nothing but Vin Diesels around you that you will have nonpolar and stuff, right on. So molecules generally are polar. You usually don't have every position with the same kind of thing. But if you do have all the same kind of atoms around it, all the same Schwarzeneggers, you will have a nonpolar molecule. Yeah, Tracy. Absolutely. Lone pairs count, any kind of atom counts and stuff. It has to be the same thing all the way around.
fluoride, F minus one, arguably has all lone pairs around it. That would be like a non-polar atom. But most of the time, yeah, like in water here, everything around the oxygen is not the same. Two hydrogens and two lone pairs, those are all different things, so that would be polar. Prop that off if you have to guess, say polar, because there's a lot more polar things than non-polar.
So here on this picture, we can see only two non-polars, like second and the fourth one?
That's right. That's right. All of these examples down here, the central atom, like carbon, has all the same things, like fluorine around it. Here it's phosphorus with nothing but fluorine. Here it's sulfur with nothing but fluorine. As long as everything around the central atom is the same, it would be nonpolar. But again, Eleonora, if you take even one of these fluorines off and you put chlorine in, that would be enough to break the symmetry, and we would then say it's polar. Very few times will we see polar. All right, last question. Yeah, go ahead.
If we had a larger atom, or a larger structure, we were picking the central atom. We were doing it in lab yesterday.
That almost always means that it's going to be polar. You have more complex things, but there are some exceptions, and in the lab you'll see more of that. But again, generally, Mackenzie, things will be polar by default, especially when they get bigger. All right, one more question.
Sorry, so if you switch one of those out, one of the fluorides, that angle would change also?
So you'd have to put something in its place, all right? But if you put a lone pair in, definitely you would see angle changes. In this class, as long as you know the generic 90, 120, and 180s, or 109s, that's fine. Technically, the lone pairs will squish the other angles together. I'm not going to make a big deal of it, though, and stuff, as long as you know the general. All right, let's look at some examples. Here's carbon dioxide and water. And if you wanted to figure out which one of these was polar, the first thing to do, draw the Lewis structure. So carbon dioxide has a carbon-oxygen double bond on both sides of it. Water up here, I've drawn it with the lone pairs. This is a molecular geometry. But you can see that the angle, the HOH angle, is about 109, maybe 107, honestly, with the lone pairs, but something like that. It's not straight across. So this, if this is me and these are Schwarzeneggers, they're pulling equally, all right? It's a double bond O on both sides. So instead of me and Schwarzenegger's, it's carbon with oxygen. Oxygen is almost like Schwarzenegger. It pulls almost as hard as anything. Only fluorine pulls harder than oxygen. But because they're equal but opposite, this is a non-polar molecule. CO2 has polar bonds. Oxygen pulls more than carbon, but the molecule itself is non-polar. Now, water has polar bonds, oxygen and hydrogen. Oxygen pulls electrons towards it, so we definitely have a dipole. This is also, though, a polar molecule. Like Tracy asked about, this thing has lone pairs on it, so the symmetry is broken on it. You will definitely have a polar molecule. BF3, Cl2CO, and NH3 all have a central atom and three pieces around it. We can figure out which of these, if any, are polar as well, again by drawing out the Lewis structure. So boron trifluoride, boron has nothing but fluorines around it. Fluorines pull electrons towards it. Those are very polar bonds, but the molecule itself, again, not polar. They're all canceling each other out. This would be an example with two strong molecules, chlorine pulling, and an even stronger oxygen pulling towards it. So little carbon in the middle doesn't have very much electron density at all. But the important part for us right now is that not everything around this carbon is the same. You've got chlorines and oxygen. If there's a break in the symmetry, that means it's going to be polar. The polarity can actually be measured. 1.17 debye is what the little D stands for. You don't need to worry about that. That's a measure of how polar this is. Pretty good polarity. Ammonia has a lone pair on top of the nitrogen. It pulls electrons towards it. There is not a symmetrical molecule because of the lone pair. And it's, as you can see, very, very polar as well. It's even more polar than the last one. So I'd like you to think about which of these molecules is or are polar. Maybe they're all nonpolar. Maybe only one of them is. Now, let's look at the easiest one first, nitrogen, all right? Nitrogen has two nitrogen atoms connected to it. Do you think that one's going to be a polar molecule or a nonpolar one?
Nonpolar,
absolutely. The same thing is pulling on itself. It's like Schwarzenegger and Schwarzenegger. Very strong, but they will cancel out, not gonna be polar. So this one is nonpolar. How about CO2? Do you remember, is this one polar or nonpolar?
Nonpolar,
that's right. The two carbon-oxygen double bonds are 180 degree apart from each other. This one is nonpolar. BCl3, we saw, I think it was BF3 earlier, whatever. Anyway, boron is completely surrounded by chlorine, so that one and stuff is nonpolar. What about ClF? Are polar, that's right. This is an example of Schwarzenegger and Vin Diesel. And again, I'm not gonna say which one is stronger, that sounds like dangerous turf war to get on, but one of them, in this case, fluorine pulls more than chlorine. Fluorine has higher electronegativity than chlorine. ClF is the only one on there that's polar, all right? And that's just because chlorine and fluorine, different electronegativities. You don't even have to know which one is pulling more than the other. You just need to realize that, yeah, these are different types of atoms coming together and they will have a different pull. Here's a series of molecules that go from CH4 methane to CCl4, carbon tetrachloride. And notice how the far left methane and the far right carbon tetrachloride are both nonpolar. That's because that central atom is surrounded by the same types of atoms. Here it's chlorines, and on the left-hand side, it's hydrogens for methane. And if you substitute in even one different atom, so here's this methane with one chlorine, here's the CCl4 with one hydrogen. Adding in just one different type of atom makes them polar. So these middle three here are all polar. Again, don't have to worry about how much polarity and stuff like that. This is just a measure of how much polarity it is. You just need to know that these three middle ones are polar. You're breaking the symmetry of the molecule, while the far left and the far right, totally symmetric, nonpolar. Yeah.
Are there any two elements that share electronegativity value?
Because I don't want you to memorize the value, I don't expect you to know that. There are some that are the same. In Chem 222 and Chem 223, if X and Y come together, you just assume that they're gonna have different polarities, different poles and stuff. But if we're gonna do research, we need to look at those kind of values because there are some that overlap, absolutely. Yeah, JD.
Is there any moment that we'll learn how to figure out net dipole?
No, you need a type of a measurement that does mass versus like a type of an attraction and stuff. I had a student who went on to graduate school at Portland State, and she did stuff like that, which was kind of cool. We don't have the type of equipment here at Mount Hood. Good. Darn Mount Hood. All right, so that's it for that chapter. For those of you that are new to my world, besides the cheesy jokes I try and include, there are study guides and concept guides in the companion. Study guides are basically bulleted lists of the parts I feel are important for each chapter. And at the end of the chapter, if you go through the study guides, just make sure you're kind of familiar with what they're talking about. That's good. If you see something foreign, then obviously ask or look it up. Concept guides are a series of worked problems from each chapter that show how to solve some of the problems we'll see. So in this chapter, there would be things on Lewis structures, things on Vesper geometry and stuff like that. All of these are in your companion and also online. And if you can't find something, of course, let me know. But now what we're gonna do is we're gonna start looking more at why Lewis structures form as they do and why we see the types of Vesper geometry that we see. And the two theories that are used to describe everything from chapter 7 are called orbital hybridization or hybridization theory and molecular orbital theory. And along the way, we're going to make diagrams which look something like this. And if you've seen a molecular orbital diagram before, maybe you understand some of this, but if for right now it looks a little strange, don't worry about it. So this section is just gonna try and justify, using the current state of theory, why molecules form as they do. So again, in this section, what we're gonna do is we're gonna try and take the S orbitals and the P orbitals and stuff like that, the atomic orbitals that go into making an atom, and we're gonna try and rationalize how you go from these types of orbitals to this kind of orbital, like in methane. And this is no small feat, because in Chem 221, this, and this are basically P orbitals. And P orbitals are essentially figure eights that are at one at 90 degrees or 180 from each other. And those three P orbitals and an S orbital or two, and S orbitals are like big balls basically, somehow are transformed into tetrahedral arrangements of things. And if you look at the atomic orbitals, at best we have 90 and 180 degree angles, and sometimes no angles at all. And somehow we're going to turn those into 109 degree orientations. So we're trying in this chapter to rationalize what's going on here. And these two competing theories both have yays and nays associated with them. Some of them are easier and some of them are harder, but they both have advantages. Now, the very best theory, in my opinion, was created by this guy named Mulliken, and it's called molecular orbital theory. And molecular orbital theory is a real powerful way to talk about those valence electrons and figure out how they make different combinations of orbitals. In molecular orbital theory, those valence electrons that we've been talking about are taken from their atomic orbitals and placed into molecular orbitals. And molecular orbitals are then placed around the whole molecule. Molecular orbital theory is really fantastic. It is the ultimate theory as far as chemists are concerned right now. But the problem with molecular orbital theory is that if you remember from Chem 221, Schrodinger's equations for figuring out the 1s, the 2s, the 2p, etc. Some pretty high-powered math, all right? You had to do some calculations with many axes and stuff like that thrown in, and we basically just looked at the results of that. In molecular orbital theory, you're taking equivalent equations, but equations for the whole molecule. So it'll be like a CH4, which is five atoms. It was difficult enough to figure out for just like one carbon atom. To make it for a molecule becomes that much more complex. So some molecular orbital theory calculations are requiring the most powerful computers that are available right now. And it's my hope that one day you'll have what I jokingly call the TI 2000 calculator. And you can put equations in for molecular orbital theories, maybe wait for a second or two, and boom, out will pop the answers. We're a long ways from that. Not quite there yet, man. So molecular orbital theory is awesome if you have the capacity to do the calculations. And what we're going to do in this class is we're going to look at some real simple examples. And we'll see how it has a lot of advantages over the other theory. But just realize that there'll be a place we'll have to stop with these because they get so crazy.
I mean, that also kind of adds the sense that you said most larger molecules are going to be polar because it's all going into one massive orbital, basically.
Yeah.
Then,
yeah, totally. And it can do some of the device stuff, JD, that you asked about too. So this is just, we're seeing the outside of the layers and stuff. And then one day some of you might delve deeper into some of this too, man. So we will look at some examples of MO theory, but they're going to be pretty basic, all right, just because the stuff gets crazy. The main theory we're going to use was also proposed by Linus Pauling, the same guy you saw who was the Oregonian scientist. And really the fancy name for it is valence bond theory. Valence bond theory you can do on the back of an envelope. It's a very easy theory that can be used to explain a lot of the things we see. It's not a super sophisticated theory, but it does work for a lot of things. So most of the time when I'm talking about molecules, I will use valence bond theory because it's easier to use. But keep molecular orbital theory in mind because it's a lot more powerful. It just you need some pretty powerful computers. In valence bond theory, the easier theory to use, those valence bonds are localized between two atoms. So instead of over the whole molecule, which is what MO tries to do, valence bond is over usually just two atoms in a bond. Those half-filled atomic orbitals will be combined to make bonds. The electrons are stabilized between two nuclei. This is an example of H2 being formed, like a hydrogen-hydrogen bond, for example. Now, when you make a molecule, I showed a slide like this earlier, there's always going to be some optimum distance that the two atoms want to be close to. If you go too far away, there's no interactions. And you get too close to things, it gets weird too, all right? So Isaiah's right here. Thank you, Isaiah, for sitting close to me. Hey, Isaiah, what's going on? Too far away. I can hardly even make out his, you know, eyes with my bad eyesight. So I have to get somewhat closer and stuff to do it. Hey, man, good to see you. This is like an optimum distance, no weirdness. So I apologize in advance. But if I get too close, I get kind of creepy and stuff. Hey, man, what are you looking at, man? You know, that's too weird with today's political climate. I'm sorry, Isaiah, I apologize in advance. That's getting too close to Isaiah. That personal space thing starts getting weird, you know? So atoms are the same way, all right? There's going to be some ideal distance, not too creepy. The energy really goes up high there right now, but not too far away so I can still say hi to Isaiah and, like, be his buddy without being weird about it. Atoms are the same way, all right? And we're going to try to always calculate then, like, these ideal distances, and those ideal distances will have an energy between them that makes it ideal and stuff.
The energy of two atoms varies with distance, according to the interplay of the attractive and repulsive forces between them.
So again, these two get together. The big sphere is the gray of the electrons, and the little red is the positive nucleus. So as they get too close, which is what happens right here, you have positive-positive repulsion, which is really strong, and the electrons are interacting as well, and they're also causing some repulsion. So you want that ideal place with minimal repulsion, but you do have bonds formed. So here's just examples of the types of interactions you might see. And the simplest one is just taking two hydrogens together. Now, if you remember from Chem 221, hydrogen was a 1s1 element. So there's one electron in a 1s orbital on hydrogen number one, and hydrogen number two also has a 1s1 electron. So they come together at some optimum place, and they create the sigma bond. And as a review from the last chapter, sigma bond just means those electrons are being smashed together to make a bond. We would draw it with a line if you want to use the actual pieces like that. So this is how the sigma bond is rationalized. It's just those electrons overlapping, not too close and not too far away. Hydrogen fluoride has a similar kind of mechanism. Fluorine, if you remember from Chem 221, was 1s2, 2s2, 2p5. And 2p5, that p5 means there was one more space for an electron, like neon is a 2p6. So when it comes to hydrogen fluoride, if they want to make a bond, you're going to use that 1s1, and you're going to use one of the 2p orbitals from fluorine, because the fluorine has space to make one more electron as well. So that's why we're using a p orbital, which is what this is. We're going to smash it into a hydrogen. The HF sigma bond is like this. These are the 2s and the other 2p electrons are just sitting around. You can do the same kind of thing for making fluorine. Two 2p orbitals will smash together. Again, the smashing part always looks kind of interesting and stuff. Don't worry about that. This would be the fluorine-fluorine sigma bond. So what we need to talk about, though, is how you go from boron in BF3 into from something which has 2s orbitals and one 2p electron into something which is trigonal planar. Now this is the atomic configuration of boron. Boron's number 5 on the periodic table. The first two electrons go in 1s, so 1s2. Then we have 2s2 for the next two electrons, and it has 1 2p electron. So 1s2, 2s2, 2p1, or you can even think about it as a helium, 2s2, 2p1. How do we go from these types of orbitals to the trigonal planar 120 degrees? Of the boron electrons, how many of them are valence electrons? 3, well done. We look at the group number above boron. Boron is in group 3. 3 of the electrons are valence. So the 2s2 and 2p1 electron are going to be really important to us. This one is too close to the nucleus. It's not going to do much in terms of bonding, but we will definitely be playing with these orbitals here in a little bit. So again, I want to reiterate what's going on here. We need to somehow rationalize how the 2s2, 2p1, those S's, which are big spheres, and P's, which are figure eights at 90 degrees from each other, how can we turn those into 120 degree angles? We don't have a lot to go with. And so what Pauling rationalizes, and there's some equations to back this up, is he says that they hybridize, the orbitals hybridize. And hybridize just means that they mix, and they come out a little bit different when all is said and done. So hybridization is used to rationalize how to go from S's and P's into these weird 120 trigonal planars. Hybrid orbitals form after the hybridization process is complete. And what interesting thing in his theory is that if we put in one S orbital and 3 P orbitals, or 4 orbitals total, we need to figure out how those 4 orbitals come out. Orbitals are conserved, like you don't make new orbitals and you don't destroy any old orbitals. So this is an example of the hybridization process in Pauling's theory. 2s2, 2p1 undergoes hybridization to make this BF3. And at the end, after hybridization is done, we end up with what they call sp2 orbitals. sp2 means it comes from one part S and two parts P. So notice that this block is kind of coming down here. Nothing's happening to that one. But these two and this one are mixing. They're hybridizing. And if they're all the same energy, then those electrons will go one to each box. This is the exclusion theory that Pauling talked about in Chem 221. You end up with 3 sp2 hybrid orbitals. Now, if you have literally 3 orbitals, all the same energy, but all with one electron, they're going to want to be as far apart from each other as they can. So those 3 orbitals with the same energy are automatically going to take up a trigonal planar geometry to keep them as far apart from each other as they can. These pictures right here try to show what the sp2 hybrid orbitals look like. Remember, there were 3 of them, and they all have the same energy, and they want to be as far apart from each other as they can. This is where the trigonal planar goes in. Now, the center right there, that's where the boron is. That's the black dot right there and the red dot right there. So again, if they want to be as far apart from each other, they can. So this sp2 orbital will react with one of the fluorine orbitals to make a sigma bond. And this sp2 orbital will react with one of the fluorine to make an sp2. Pretty strange. So in gold box right here, we have 3 half-filled hybrid orbitals. And because they're all the same energy, supposedly, they will want to be as far apart from each other as they can. They make sp2 bonds, and those bonds create sigma bonds when they smash into fluorine. Let me show you a video here. This is BH3 instead of BF3, but it's the same thing. So what happens is those sigma bonds are hybridized. They want to be as far apart from each other as they can. So this blue right here, these are the sp2 bonds. And this one electron is in the sp2, it comes up to fluorine, and it smashes into each, making a sigma bond. This is the BF single bond that we would draw. Now, Prof, if everything I just said was Greek or gobbledygook to you, don't despair. The important thing about hybridization theory is to know the hybridization of the central atom. And the punchline of this whole argument, anytime you see trigonal planar, you will call it sp2 hybridized. Any questions before we leave? All right, let's stop here. We'll go on with an example of methane on Friday. Have a good day. I will see you soon.